The Bolivarian Revolution marches forward, and it has made impressive progress in poverty alleviation, food sovereignty, social housing, and economic growth, working closely with China, Russia, Iran, Nicaragua, and other countries towards a multipolar system of international relations based on sovereignty, non-interference, and the principles of the UN Charter. However, the US has been stepping up regime change efforts in Venezuela. Under Biden, it recognized failed opposition candidate Edmundo González as president and placed a $25 million bounty on the head of President Nicolás Maduro. We have seven very well-informed speakers, and I'll confine myself for that reason to a couple of background points. The first concerns the legitimacy of Maduro's election, on which we and our partners have held several webinars. And as you will see, and as you will know if you saw them, there was a systematic attempt during the election not merely to discredit the process renowned for its democratic character, but to use this as the occasion for a coup. This coup failed, and this is the background to the renewed US offensive. In preparation, the US and its allies, as normal, have engaged in a systematic campaign of distortion. These campaigns are very pernicious and have the aim both lining up liberal so-called opinion in the West and vacillators in Latin America itself. The second point, and this is very exciting, is the upcoming visit of two people. Marco Rubio, Trump's new head of state, has gone to Panama, and Trump's envoy for special missions, Richard Grenell, has gone to Venezuela itself, where he has just met with President Maduro, on which we hopefully will hear from our presenters. Now, Rubio has recently published on the State Department website a rambling interview with Megan Ryan, in which, among other things, he declares that the unipolar moment is over and that contentious matters should be settled by diplomacy. The problem is what the administration means by diplomacy. Rubio's own account of his purpose makes interesting reading. Quote, mass migration, drugs, and hostile policies pursued by Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela have wreaked havoc, he says. All the while, the Chinese Communist Party uses diplomatic and economic leverage, such as the Panama Canal, to oppose the US and turn sovereign nations into vassal states. Now, as to Panama, Trump, as we know, has simply declared his intention to re-annex it. If the bounty on Maduro's head is any indication of what diplomacy still means, the world had better watch out. Nor has there been any let-up under Trump so far, just an amplification of the illegal and inhuman sanctionings, and a rescinding of even minor Biden-era oil import concessions. The explicit coupling of three of Latin America's most revolutionary governments to Trump's attack on China should make us fully aware that in the USA's backyard, there will be no let up in the assault on Latin America's people. So without more ado, I'm going to start with our first speaker, Maria Paez Victor. She is a sociologist, born in Venezuela and educated in Caracas, New York, Mexico City, England, and Canada. For several years, she taught the sociology of health and medicine, as well as health and environmental policies at the University of Toronto. She has national and international experience in policy analysis and impact assessment, with expertise in the areas of health, environment, and energy. So I'd like to welcome Maria Paez Victor.
I will not touch upon the recent elections or the inauguration. I will leave that to the other panelists. I will just say Nicolas Maduro won the elections fair and square with 52% of the votes. That's about 6 million votes, a fact that was witnessed and backed by the election authorities and by the Supreme Court of the land and by hundreds of independent observers. By the way, Trump won with only 49% of the votes. I will let the election observers on the panel talk about this experience. But this I will say, the enemies of the Bolivarian Revolution, both domestic and international, especially the US empire, have built up a campaign to malign the elections in order to bolster the idea of a coup and invasion. I pay no heed to them. They have presented no evidence whatsoever about fraud, even though the authorities have asked them for it. This was the 30th election in Venezuela in the last 25 years. The Venezuelan people love to vote and also are keen to protest and protect their rights. So if there was any doubt in anybody's mind that Nicolas Maduro had won the elections, how come the people are not out on the street protesting? Why? Because they know Nicolas Maduro won. Now, Venezuela has the misfortune of having the largest oil reserve in the world, which the United States covets. As Hugo Chavez advanced the Bolivarian Revolution, it became clear that undeniable advances were being made in the economic development of Venezuela that were evident in substantial improvements to the life of Venezuelans. It established free medical services in towns, villages, neighborhoods. Schools at every level were built. Food access was plentiful. Jobs were created. Poverty was reduced drastically, as well as inequality. The infrastructure was improved and built. In summary, the Bolivarian had become that rare thing, a rich socialist revolution with the funds to transform and create economic and social development. Just think, when Russia did its revolution, they were broke. When Cuba started its revolution, they were broke. Well, Venezuela was not broke. And the Western capitalist nations, instead of lauding these accomplishments that had reduced poverty and misery, reviled it. It was a bad example. Anything that smacked of socialism had to be stopped on its tracks. They willfully ignored the progressive constitution and all the legal and policy implementation of human rights for women, children, indigenous peoples, the handicapped, and the environment. They blocked everything of this nature with the lie that Venezuela had become a dictatorship, despite the elections, of course, and presented no evidence to substantiate these claims, vilifying President Maduro as a dictator. All the participatory, democratic innovations that we should really talk about that Venezuela has developed were willfully ignored and twistingly interpreted. Therefore, under the false excuses about defending democracy, the U.S. imposed illegal economic sanctions and an economic and financial blockade that are far-reaching, malicious, and a crime against humanity, as UN human rights raconteurs have decried. The aim was to destroy all the advances of the Bolivarian Revolution, to impoverish the population and bring down the legitimate government. It was a vile siege, like in medieval times, counting on the suffering of the population to turn on its government. Since 2015, more than 1,000 illegal sanctions thrust upon Venezuela by the USA, followed by its minions, Canada and the EU. It was barred from the international financial system, denied SWIFT. And I am going to repeat this because this is astonishing. Look at what they've robbed of Venezuela. All its assets in foreign banks, 7 million. Its assets in the IMF, 5 billion. The Sitka Oil Company, 10 billion. 31 tons of gold in the Bank of England stolen, 2 billion. It was prevented from buying and selling on the international market. Couldn't produce or sell its oil, could not buy food or medicine. And immorally, this I want everyone to remember, during a pandemic, COVID vaccines were denied Venezuela. Now, this is an astonishing statistics, but it's true. The government's income was reduced by 95%, and Venezuela's GDP suffered the greatest drop by any country, even in wartime. In the last 7 years, the blockade and the sanctions have cost the nation a total of $642 billion. And this is worse than all of that. 100,000 Venezuelans have died as a direct result of the inhuman U.S. sanctions, fully backed by Canada and the EU. This was a catastrophic situation, driving many to leave the country, about 2 million. Yet, amazingly, the economy did not collapse. There was no famine. The government did not fall. The sanctions failed to reach its goal. It's astonishing, unheard of in any nation, that a country so hammered economically with illegal sanctions, which reduced the income by 95%, produced losses to its economy, has not collapsed as the Western media predicted over and over. This remarkable strength in face of adversity is a testament to the social and political cohesion of Venezuela and its Bolivarian transformation. During these years of economic blockade, there has been no famine in Venezuela, no civil war, no chaos, no breaking of social order. And one of the most remarkable events was during the pandemic when the Western nations refused to allow Venezuela to buy their vaccines. Nevertheless, Venezuela had the lowest death rates in the entire continent. Thanks to China, Russia, Cuba, Venezuela managed to finally get vaccines. And more importantly, thousands of grassroots organizations helped the public health authorities to teach the population about disease and promote masks and social distancing and testing. Nobody was complaining this was an impediment against their freedom, but as an exercise in caring for themselves and one's neighbor. Today, 2025, Venezuela has risen from the ashes like the phoenix. The government of Venezuela, led by Maduro, looked at its resources and alternatives. It developed strategies to diversify the economy, promote its agriculture and grow food, export other natural resources, promote domestic manufacturing and commerce, and open other international markets for its products. Today, for example, it builds computers, cars, drones, even planes. It was helped by the solidarity and support it received in aids and loans from allies such as China, Russia, India, Iran, Cuba, and many others. It survived and it eliminated hyperinflation. But it's important to underline that the government was joined in this patriotic economic endeavor by millions of Venezuelans, organized in many grassroots organizations, including commune, which had a key role, and unions, as well as private enterprise that helped withstand the sanction. Okay, what are the results? The result is that Venezuela now has the fastest growing GDP in the region, according to not the Bolivarian government, but Credit Suisse. And it's at 9% a year, rising, exceeding even the government's expectations. Venezuela is now virtually self-sufficient in food. It delivered in 2024 alone 132 million food boxes. It has built 5 million housing units in the past 7 years. I underline this especially for all of us Canadians out there that we can't seem to build one house. Venezuela looked at the wide world beyond the United States, which had been practically its only oil buyer in the past, and survived. The USA, Canada, and their allies failed to isolate it diplomatically or economically. And its population, according to consistent polls, has a positive, optimistic outlook of their future. So from the ashes of an economy, the economy is now more sustainable and diversified, and a society that is more cohesive and viable. It is evident. Now, even the private sector, which used to be, you know, number one conspirators, now even Fidecámaras and other chambers of commerce have accepted the government and renounced violence. Now, this new era of the Bolivarian Revolution that has brought about substantial social cohesion is due in great part to the fact that the government, with whatever meager resources it had, it dedicated all it could to the social security of its people. It's very hard, if not impossible, to successfully carry out a coup d'etat against a highly popular government that is taking care of you. With great personal and public sacrifices, the government of Nicolas Maduro dedicated a great majority of resources it had on hand for what Venezuelans called la deuda social, that is, the social debt. That is, for the urgent necessities of the people, a people that during 40 years before the revolution was practically marginalized, excluded from the petroleum riches and benefits. For example, today, the budget for the government for 2025 dedicates 77.6% of it to social investment. Today, Venezuela is self-sufficient in food, has a diversified economy, has the highest GDP growth in Latin America, produces 1 million barrels of oil a day, and sells to a host of international markets. It's not just selling oil, but selling all sorts of products, agricultural, mineral, and manufactured. And Venezuela got rid of hyperinflation. Now, this is important, an important characteristic of the social security system of Venezuela is due in fact to its historic roots as well as its socialist vision. The funds for the public services are not classified like costs, like in capitalist countries, but as social investment. And this is really important because Venezuela has turned upside down this stigma of poverty, which in capitalist countries people are blamed individually for their poverty and not the structural stuff. So now in Venezuela, people understand that the government and the society owes the people. It's a stroke of genius to combat the stigma of inequality and of poverty. I could go on about the right-wing movements in Europe and the United States, but I just want to say that it will be Venezuela and countries like Venezuela that embrace a socialist programs who will be the ones who will be in less conflict in the coming years. And Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution is the shining example for the world to see and learn from. Thank you.
I now want to introduce Camila Escalante, who is a journalist who has recently traveled to Venezuela, a correspondent for Press TV, and the editor of the online outlet Causachun News.
I've spent a bit of time in Venezuela over the past 7 years, and I've witnessed the importance of the Bolivarian Revolution for the progress of the country and its people, and the influence of the Bolivarian Revolution that it's had on the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean. Under the leadership of Commander Hugo Chavez, followed by the leadership of President Nicolas Maduro, countries and peoples of our region have benefited from cooperation initiatives with Venezuela, which, despite the all-out economic war, has shared its resources with its neighbors. And over the last 26 years, Caracas became one of the most important meeting places for political parties and people's movements of Latin America and the Caribbean and world. And tomorrow, we are commemorating 26 years since Commander Chavez first took office on February 2nd, 1999. Last year, we saw the launch of the Anti-Fascist International, a creation of President Nicolas Maduro, which is a direct response to the problems we're confronting today all around the world. Now we're seeing the importance of Venezuela not only for its own people's advancement and for the step forward we've taken in establishing socialism on our continent, but Venezuela now is a symbol of the fight against international fascism. And since 2024 is one of the bases from which we're directly confronting this phenomenon. So I think it's very important to give emphasis to this process of the forming of the international, the Anti-Fascist International, which was the idea of President Nicolas Maduro and comes from Venezuela, because it's very important at this time. And we have to understand Venezuela not only as a lighthouse or an example for the region, but now for the entire world, given what we're experiencing and living through now. So some of the other speakers may also mention that Caracas hosted the International Anti-Fascist World Festival a couple weeks ago, January 9th through the 11th, with the participation of about 2,000 delegates from all continents who traveled to Venezuela with the purpose of uniting against fascism and to plan the strategic defeat of fascism. This process is a silver lining in this moment in the global class struggle. This meeting had a final resolution in which they stated the following purposes. They said that this International Anti-Fascist Congress will continue to advance in the organization and consolidation of chapters of the Anti-Fascist International in each country, region, continent, creating a global platform for the struggle against fascism with an executive secretariat. And it will create and launch a think tank of the Anti-Fascist International called Caracas Forum to establish spaces for strategic analysis and anti-fascist praxis in each country, region, and continent. Is proposed to convene a major world meeting of think tanks. And they also propose in the final declaration a training camp for youth comrades committed to the building of a new world. They proposed including the religious sector, which is very important for Latin America, because Latin America, which has in many countries a strong tendency to have people who are followers of Christian faith, both Catholic and evangelical and otherwise, are not going to leave the Christian faith overnight. And so it's very important that any revolutionary process include those people who are followers of that faith. This Anti-Fascist International also proposed in its final declaration a international meeting of political training schools, a World Anti-Fascist Congress of Indigenous Peoples, many of whom already participated in some of the congresses and meetings in the last year, and a meeting of jurists against fascism. And I want to talk a little bit about what qualifies Venezuela to lead this process against fascism and its experience it's had with confronting fascism in the country. You know, Venezuela has itself confronted the ideology of hate as espoused by the far right in the country, the far right opposition, which has refused to accept many of the elections that have taken place in the country over the past two decades. That opposition promoted, financed, organized, and unleashed violence in the form of what we call guarimbas, but also in the form of false flag attacks, even at times harming their own people, their own followers in the streets, and also targeting in general the general population of Venezuela. Among the most gruesome and vile acts of terror, as many people know, has been the hanging of thin wire across streets in Caracas to slit the throats of motorcyclists when motorcycles are a main source of transportation in that city and in the country. I interviewed about a week ago in Caracas a young political analyst named Annalise Blanco, and she told me that the Bolivarian ideology cannot consent or cannot afford the luxury of retreating in the face of these conditions of fascism. She said, here in Venezuela, things were achieved like never before with the Bolivarian Revolution, such as the recognition of women and the corresponding ministry, such as the ministries that deal with the issues of indigenous peoples and helping with the inclusion of people living with disabilities and illness. And this is a country and a government which has found successes in doing so despite the economic war that persists against the country, and that this is a country that is focused on inclusion and empowerment. Now I'm summarizing what she said, in contrast with the governments such as the government of Javier Milei in Argentina, which is adopting and following the sort of lead that's being put forth by the United States, and which the countries such as Argentina, such as Ecuador under Daniel Noboa, are becoming countries of exclusion where people are being increasingly disenfranchised. Venezuela has also taken the lead on many important key world issues in the last few years. Venezuela was among the very first and the loudest to state its position in solidarity with the people of Russia and the government in its efforts to try to bring to an end the Nazism and extremism found in Ukraine. Venezuela also has taken a very important stand against the Zionist entity and the terrorism it unleashes on the people of Gaza in the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people, and has also warned of Zionism's threats against the rest of the world and its immediate region, which attacks, obviously, the people of Lebanon, Iran, Syria, and elsewhere. It's noteworthy that the Venezuelan far-right opposition, in the wake of everything that has transpired in the collapse of the former government of Syria, the Venezuelan opposition has called for that sort of fate to take place in Venezuela as well. They want to see what has happened to Gaddafi happen to President Nicolas Maduro. And they do so knowing that something like that would cause a civil war in the country. Venezuela has also stood time and time again with all of the other countries which are facing economic warfare, such as Iran, Zimbabwe, North Korea, and others who are the target of unilateral coercive measures, just like our Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela itself. So for these reasons and a whole lot of others, it makes the most sense that Venezuela is leading this very important process to deal a defeat to international fascism once and for all. It's the very beginning of a process, one that began with Congress in September of 2024, But for that reason, the Bolivarian Revolution now stands for more than just all of the different works and achievements of the last 26 years within the country, which has helped bring about social inclusion and a sort of semi-participatory democracy within the country. But also now Venezuela is once again lending itself to the peoples of the world in the different struggles that we're fighting right now to confront the new times. And I'll end there. Thank you very much.
So I'm now going to take Dan Kovalik. Dan graduated from Columbia Law School in 93. He currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He wrote Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Intervention and Resistance in 2023, and The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, which includes a foreword by Oliver Stone in 2019. He served as in-house counsel for the United Steelworkers for 26 years. He has been traveling to Nicaragua since 1987 and has been a friend of Nicaragua and the Sandinista Revolution since then. He writes extensively on human rights, international human rights, and U.S. foreign policy for the Huffington Post, Counterpunch, and RT News, and has lectured throughout the world on these subjects.
Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. I just returned from Syria last night, so forgive me if I'm not on the top of my game. But I'm thinking about Venezuela. I want to talk a bit about Venezuela through the lens of Syria, because what we saw in Syria, what we're seeing now, is the result of years of draconian sanctions by the West against Syria, and also a war, by the way, a very brutal war, of course, that the West brought to Syria, which, thank goodness, Venezuela has not had to endure. But in the end, the war was not, you know, had not been a real big factor in Syria since 2020, because they had reached an agreement to basically cease hostilities between essentially these terrorist groups and the government in Damascus. But the last 4 years, the sanctions, which have continued there, they what are called the Caesar sanctions, really paved the way for what happened about a month ago, where you had this group called HTS, which is basically Al-Qaeda, take over Syria. And that is exactly the type of thing they want to do to Venezuela. That is what the sanctions are intended to do in Venezuela. And the sanctions against Venezuela have been just as brutal against that country as the sanctions against Syria. It must be noted that it was Trump that imposed really the worst of the sanctions, I believe, back in 2017, which at that time brought revenue in Venezuela to almost nothing. I mean, really, there was a moment where it was bringing in no money, in which it was having difficulty feeding its people, getting medicine for its people. Maria Victor at the beginning, who gave a great introduction, mentioned the figure, I believe, of 100,000 Venezuelans dying due to sanctions. Well, that was a figure that Alfred de Zayas, the UN expert, had given, I think, in around 2019, thought about 100,000 people had died up to that point due to the sanctions. Well, you know, many more died after 2019. So I think 100,000 is probably a low estimate of the people who died due to the lack of medicines, life-saving medicines. And again, that 2019 figure, which de Zayas gave, was before COVID, right? So think of all the people who may have died due to COVID because they could not get the COVID vaccine, as Maria pointed out. They couldn't even get masks or other protective gear that they needed because of the sanctions. So certainly many, many tens of thousands of Venezuelans died due to the sanctions. And as Maria pointed out, the U.S. stole Venezuela's single largest source of revenue, which was its U.S.-based petroleum company, CITGO. And right now, CITGO, as far as I know, is being sold off in pieces. That was the plan anyway, in a federal court greenlit that. And so Venezuela may never get that back, you know, a huge source of revenue, which brought in billions of dollars for Venezuela. So the fact that Venezuela is still standing, is able to feed its people, able to provide health care, able to build these 5 million homes that Maria pointed out, is really nothing short of miraculous. Again, especially when you see what happened to Syria. And again, I just returned from Syria, and it is still, you know, whole cities are still rubble because the U.S. never allowed Syria to reconstruct from that war. And again, that is what allowed the regime change to happen there. And by the way, one of our talking points always used to be that, oh, well, sanctions don't really do what they're intended to do anyway, and that is cause regime change. I think in the case of Syria, it really did do that. And so, you know, we really have our work cut out for us. As I mentioned, it was Trump that imposed those Caesar sanctions. It was Trump that recognized Juan Guaido as the fraudulent president of Venezuela, which it turns out was nothing merely but a ploy to have a conduit in Guaido to give all these billions of dollars that the U.S. was withholding and stealing from Venezuela. God knows where all that money is now, right? And now, of course, Biden recognized Edmundo Gonzalez as the president of Venezuela. We'll see how that turns out. But I think the main takeaway is that the Venezuelan revolution continues. It is strong. Why I did not make it there for the inauguration, I saw that, you know, the videos of the opposition protest were tiny. Meanwhile, you had huge numbers of people who did turn out to support Nicolas Maduro. And I think those on this webinar who've been to Venezuela before also know that the truth is you can tell a Maduro rally from an opposition rally. And that is because it's largely brown people who come to the Maduro rallies. And it's usually, you know, the whiter, blue-eyed people who go to the opposition rallies. And that's because the Chavista Nicolas Maduro governments have supported the rights of Afro-Venezuelans, of indigenous peoples, in a way they've never been supported before and indeed never been recognized before. These have been invisible people prior to Chavez. And they have been put forward by the revolution, which really should be a reason that, you know, progressive people in the United States should support Venezuela. And I don't think they've gotten the support from progressives that they deserve. And so it's a testament to Maduro that he continues to have his support from the working and poor people, from Afro-Venezuelans, from indigenous peoples. And that is the heart of the revolution. Obviously, the task before us is to continue to support Venezuela in resisting the sanctions and resisting what I think will be, under Trump and Marco Rubio, a much more aggressive foreign policy towards Venezuela, a foreign policy that will be designed to try to upend Venezuela and turn Venezuela into another Syria.
I now have great pleasure in asking Arnold August to join us. Now, Arnold has an MA in political science from McGill, and he completed 2 years of PhD studies in the same field. He's based in Montreal, and he specializes in geopolitics and international relations, the global South, multipolarity, Latin America, and ALBA, Venezuela and Cuba. He also focuses on Palestine, indigenous peoples, China, BRICS, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He has visited Venezuela 5 times, including for the presidential elections, as an international observer, and written over 40 articles on Venezuela. So it's with great pleasure I ask Arnold to join us.
I'm going to deal with 4 points to try to keep it within 10 minutes or so. The first point is reporting back from Venezuela. I've been to Venezuela, I think it was the 6th time a short while ago, but always for a period of not more than 2 weeks, which is relatively small. So when I go to Venezuela, I have started this tradition back in July of 2024 of meeting with Venezuelans who are on the ground, who live there, and who analyze. And exchange ideas with them. This started, for example, with the Orinoco Tribune, for example, with Jesus, as well as Venezuela Analysis, and also Mission Verdad. Now, coming out of these discussions back in July and in January, the issue of fraud in the elections always comes up. We have no choice. We have to deal with it. But I translated an article by Mission Verdad in English, a very short article, which, you know, sort of breaks it down. Now, in addition to that, fraud, I say, you know, the situation has changed. You know, anyone claiming fraud that Maduro is not the legitimate president, they have a problem now. Because 3 or 4 days ago, the New York Times called for an invasion of Venezuela. The day after, Marco Rubio also called for an invasion of Venezuela. And the day after that, Trump's special envoy, Grenell, met with Trump. And the day after that, which is yesterday, Friday, he was in Caracas shaking hands with Maduro. Now, I don't want to exaggerate it, but the fact is this happened. And I think it's a big defeat for the opposition. Guaido had a hard time. He had to delete a previous tweet in which he called Maduro a dictator. So they're doing damage control. And the State Department is trying to undo that whole thing by saying the only reason he went to Venezuela because there's no Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. I don't think that is the case. We should not exaggerate it. But I think what Maduro said about that is very right. He said at least, first, that we defended our right to sovereignty. We made it clear, if you want to have good relations with Venezuela, you have to respect our constitution, which means respect Maduro as the elected president of Venezuela. And thirdly, he said, I think it's very significant, we have now opened direct channels between Caracas and Washington, D.C., which in my view is significant because it's a way, perhaps, I don't want to be overly optimistic, it is perhaps a way to overcome the pressure of the deep state, Marco Rubio, to go back to the very violent attack by the United States against Venezuela. But time will tell. But, you know, Trump is a wild card. But I think this is a very positive thing that took place in Caracas the other day. And I think that it, more than anything, shows that the issue of fraud in elections, I think we have to put that aside, is no longer to be considered an important point. Now, my second point, eyewitness report, January 9th. I was there when the opposing demonstration took place. On the one hand, by the so-called the opposition, Edmundo Garcia and Machado. It was very clear they were very small, tiny. We're talking about hundreds of people. Very small, tiny demonstration that took place. At the same time, that same day, myself and others who were there were able to participate in the huge tens and tens of thousands of Chavistas demonstrating, including in well-off areas, to support the process in Venezuela and allow the January 10th swearing-in ceremony to take place. There's another point I would like to mention with regards to the controversy of opposition and Chavistas on January 9th, and that is, it's not spoken enough about, that there are opposition forces in Venezuela who do not support Machado and Gonzalez. In fact, I read their tweets, I even spoke to them on the street. They have a very sharp criticism of Machado, accusing them of all kinds of things, including attempt to incite violence in Venezuela. And they also said yesterday, we ran against Maduro, but we support the fact that he is the legitimate president. This is not insignificant. And that's why U.S. and its allies never talk about this opposition. They only have their opposition. And this is another proof that they are what is going on. And this same opposition yesterday, in supporting Maduro as the rightful president, also said that they will participate as an opposition in the upcoming local elections, which are scheduled to take place in April. That is, elections for the governors of each state, as well as the elections of the legislative assembly of each state, as well as the National Assembly members of parliament. Very significant. I think this is another indication of the protagonist democracy that has been developing since Chavez won the elections in 1998. Now, the third point I'll be dealing with is Maduro. I've been to Venezuela several times. I've heard him speak several times. But I heard him once again directly on January 9th and January 10th. It's really impressive. This former bus driver who has withstood all of the attacks, including assassination attempts, is so clear and sincere and deep in his analysis of his own country. Every time he speaks, he goes into the history of Venezuela, from the first indigenous uprisings against the Spanish to the rising of the Afro-Venezuelans against the Spanish, and of course, those who have followed in this path. Now, you know, one has to take into account the sincerity of Maduro. You know, there's no doubt about it. He is really an important personality. You know, it says a peaceful transition from Chavez to Maduro. And I think that this is very significant. Now, when he spoke on January 9th and 10th, we know that there were several presidents from Latin America who took, very opportunistic stance regarding the Maduro election back July, even challenging it on very similar grounds as the State Department that was fraud and all that. But when he spoke on January 9th and January 10th, he did not mention any of these, what I would call middle of the roaders, to be polite. Rather, what he did mention was the patriotic, traditional fighters in each of these countries, whether it's in Brazil, Colombia, etc., and the role that they have played in history, and showing this is the example that these countries and Latin America have to show as they go forward. So I think, in addition to everything else, he's an extremely good diplomat, which is not an easy thing to do under the conditions. The fourth and last point, I read a fantastic piece a few months ago by En Fu Cheng, who was a very well-known Chinese international Marxist scholar. I think many of you from IMG and Friends of Social China are aware of his work. It was fascinating. He dealt with 500 years, five centuries of the development of socialism from the beginning to now. And towards the end, it was an interview, the person who interviewed him asked, well, what do you think about the current situation in other countries? And he made some very important remarks. He said he visited several countries. The theme of the interview was this. It was a socialist planned economy and socialist market economy, right? Very controversial, very profound, and very important. What he said, he visited Vietnam. He visited Laos. He visited DPRK. And he said they're on this path as well. And then there are countries that he did not visit, but he did mention Venezuela and Chavez and the 21st century socialism. So my basic conclusion is the organizers had a very good idea, having as a title of this seminar, Defending the Bolivarian Revolution. And I'm sort of building on what Francisco Domingo said. We have to defend the Bolivarian Revolution because in my view, it is a very important example of how it's developing its economy by mixing planned socialist and planned market economy. And I think this is one of the reasons that the United States is determined to overthrow Maduro because of this example. Thank you.
Now, our last speaker is Fiona Sim, and she is co-founder and organizer of the Black Liberation Alliance, an organization founded in 2020 to build anti-imperialist unity of African, Asian, Arab, and Caribbean communities in Britain and beyond. She's currently based in London, and she is a member of the Friends of Socialist China Britain Committee and has written for CGTM, The Morning Star, and several other outlets. So a big welcome to Fiona, our last speaker.
Thank you so much for having me. It's kind of relevant to my speech later on, actually, but I've just come from the anti-fascist rally that's been held in central London today against some masters of Tommy Robinson fans, followers, supporters who have decided to congregate in Whitehall. They tried to come and rally in front of Downing Street today, but there was a huge sort of anti-fascist counter demonstration. I believe there are about like 5,000 people in attendance from all sorts of trade unions, religious organizations, anti-racist, anti-fascist organizations. And it was a really sort of like powerful event that, even in the cold, cold months of winter, people are still sort of like turning out on the streets in anti-fascist demonstration. And I guess it sort of links quite nicely to the fact that there was a delegation that went to Venezuela with VSC earlier in January. I was really, really honored to have been part of that delegation. And we came for the World Anti-Fascist Festival in Caracas. And it turned out to be the festival came out of the first international anti-fascist congresses held in November of 2024 in the sort of autumn time. So there was the very first one happened in September, and I was fortunate enough to go to the Youth Congress for anti-fascists in November, and then there was a second follow-up as well. And it was just it's just been an incredible experience to be able to go to Venezuela sort of twice in the past couple of months and really sort of experience and see how organizing anti-fascism and the anti-fascist movement really should be. And it's proven to be such an amazing inspiration as well to myself as an organizer here in Britain. And it's really been sort of like a motivating factor to sort of keep going and keep pushing ahead, even despite all the travesties and dismal things going on and happening in the world right now. But more on, I guess, the festival in Venezuela itself. So it was a really sort of vibrant sort of coming together of 2,000, I think it was over 2,000 delegates from 125 countries in January who came for the inauguration, who came for the sort of events that had that were sort of like sandwiching it, which formed the World Anti-Fascist Festival. And it was really important, I think, that Venezuela has inaugurated itself as the anti-fascist epicenter of the world. It couldn't come at a more important time, especially when the black populations of the world are sort of seated on the tectonic plates of imperialism, where, you know, the black populations of the world, and I use black in the political sense in the terms of including African, Asian, Arab, Caribbean, and indigenous peoples in the political black sense. And all these people from all these countries, they are currently holding their breaths to see what on earth are the imperialists going to do next? What is Donald Trump going to do next? What are the Malays of the world going to do next? What on earth is Keir Starmer, the leader of the apparent Labour Party, going to do? And as we have seen, obviously, in Palestine, we can't, whether a government proclaims itself to be more progressive or more leftist or more rightist, especially in the West, it doesn't necessarily always become or lead to anti-imperialist policies, to multilateral and peaceful policies. And as we can see, Britain's sort of attitudes towards Venezuela, especially during the inauguration sort of time, I still remember standing, I think it was outside the presidential palace, where on the day of the inauguration of President Maduro. And it was really interesting because you just had this sea of people from all walks of life from all around the world, including indigenous Venezuelans, indigenous peoples from Panama, from Guatemala, from Honduras, Peru, all around the world and all across Latin America. And then my phone just pings and it says BBC, you know, the UK has decided to put XYZ sanctions on all these individuals. And essentially the US has put a bounty on Maduro's head, or has increased the bounty on Maduro's head. And just to have that juxtaposition of the imperialist desperation at a time that was full of so much joy, of so much community, solidarity and unity against imperialism, against fascism and colonialism in Venezuela, in sort of like what is now the anti-fascist epicenter of the world, it just sort of sharpened the contradictions of where we need to be focused as a left and where we need to be mobilizing not just our interests, but also our resources in combating disinformation and combating some of the more egregious sort of policies being led by our so-called leaders here in the British government. And I think one important thing as well that should be stressed is that the importance of bringing all these people from all around the world to Venezuela, there's nothing quite like it, because you're bringing people from Africa, from Asia, and who are also fighting for their sovereignty. You're bringing people from Palestine, you're bringing Palestinians studying in Cuba, all the way to Caracas to share in this monumentous sort of occasion. But it's also an opportunity, and it was an opportunity for all of us to network and to learn from each other, to learn about all the different anti-imperialist struggles going on. For example, in the Sahel, we met with so many comrades from Burkina Faso, from Niger, from Mali, who were hand in hand with Venezuela, but also struggling against the imperialist forces who are trying to leverage ECOWAS into toppling the sort of people-led popular coups, popular movements that have led to the overthrow of French imperialism in the region. So connecting those struggles on a very literally on the ground sort of level is such an incredibly interesting and fascinating place to be, because you're not just learning from someone over a screen, although obviously webinars like this are incredible, but there's something about getting to break bread with people, getting to have dinner with people and learning about their struggles, but also learning about how resilient they are in the face of imperialism. And I think Venezuela is just such an incredible example of resilience. And the youth, I cannot talk about enough the youth, just the energy, the spirit, the commitment of the young people there. And it's a real inspiration, I think, not just to myself, as I guess I'm still a young person for now, but to just the movement over here and how much we can learn from the vibrancy and tenacity in the face of the most horrific sanctions that are causing a lot of suffering, that are not helping with things like poverty and exacerbating already very fragile living situations and economic downturns. And I think in the heart of empire, we all know that British school children don't really learn about the anti-colonial revolutionaries, whether it's Toussaint or Ho Chi Minh or Patrice Lumumba, they all go unacknowledged. So it's not any surprise, really, that if you were to say the name Simon Bolivar to anyone in Britain, would anyone even know who that is? Would anyone even be able to speak on the Bolivarian Revolution? The answer is most likely absolutely not. In fact, the only things they've probably heard about the Bolivarian Revolution are the disinformation that is being spread through mainstream media outlets like the BBC, like CNN, and obviously on platforms like X and TikTok. Venezuela has had a significant problem with disinformation being spread through social media, it's being spread through quick 10-second, 30-second videos that give out all these impressions of Venezuela as this oppressive place run by a dictatorship, and you know that all that migrants are invading, that this and that, very similar to the rhetoric being heard by actually Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage and Donald Trump. But in Venezuela, when we were there, we learned a lot about how the youth are really trying to mobilize to combat that by trying to beat them at their own game. So not by turning away from TikTok. In fact, one of the things that the youth are really encouraging the president to do is to promote people and get people to sort of produce more content and to defeat the disinformation by producing legitimate information. And I think that's, again, where the importance of Venezuela and the importance of defending Venezuela comes in, because they're really honing in on the idea of world internationalist solidarity, bringing us together as a global community to defeat fascism, to defeat colonialism and racism and all of the relevant sort of forms of oppression that aren't just affecting Venezuelans, but affecting indigenous Latin Americans, that are affecting Africans across the world, Asians across the world. We've all seen how the disinformation campaigns targeting China have really exacerbated the emergence of the new Cold War. And with Donald Trump threatening tariffs on Mexico, Brazil, China, anyone who associates themselves with BRICS, now is the time that we really need to be unified and in solidarity and to come together, because this, if anything, is the key time to challenge and maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but to topple US hegemony. Because the US is scared of all of us coming together. It's scared of the Black populations of the world organizing and realizing we can overthrow our imperialist masters, that we can believe in a better world that is possible, that is led by the peoples, whether it's the Chavistas, the Sandinistas, the comrades in China who have been, who have celebrated very recently the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, or even, you know, in the Sahel states who are all emerging and trying to figure out how they're going to establish their place in the world as sovereign states and how to become more self-reliant and less reliant on the forces of the West. Because as we all know, the West simply cannot be trusted. And I just feel so, again, so elated to have been part of these events in Venezuela, in Caracas, and being able to speak to the Venezuelan youth and talk to them about their politics and how sort of optimistic they were. There was just so much emotion at the inauguration. When we watched the swearing-in ceremony, we were all in a hotel huddled around this little television in the reception area. And when I tell you that people were sobbing, like people were so, so emotional, because this came after months and months of, you know, of uncertainty, of tension, of an incredibly violent summer. So when we were talking to them, we asked them, you know, can we get a message from you to our comrades back in Britain? And they were like, yes, yes, of course. And they gave these 2-minute impassioned videos talking about how they've fought incredibly hard to get to where they are, to even get people into Caracas to Venezuela, to get to the point where they could watch the rightful president become inaugurated in. It was a huge struggle, and they don't take that for granted. And they wanted us, one of the key messages was that they didn't want us to take it for granted here, especially in the West, that just because we're comfortable now doesn't mean we'll be comfortable tomorrow. Just because the fascists haven't quote unquote won today, it doesn't mean they won't win tomorrow. We have to be there out on the streets, in our workplaces, in our trade unions, struggling with one another every single day and every single waking hour. And of course, we can't ignore the very, very, very tenacious force of racism and how it's utilized to divide us, to divide, you know, even to divide the Venezuelan people, to divide the indigenous Venezuelans and Afro-Venezuelans from the white population, from the, you know, the settler population from when the Spanish first colonized. And so it's these divisions, coupled with, of course, class being the primary sort of contradiction here, that we really need to hone in on here in Britain. And we must take inspiration from the Bolivarian Revolution if we are to have our own successful revolutionary processes. So I think that's the key message I just really wanted to get across to everybody today, is that there's so much inspiration to take from Venezuela. And as much as we should be learning from them, and just out of interest, just out of our knowledge, but we should also be learning from Venezuela to learn how to apply their revolutionary struggle to our specific situation, and what connections we can make with the peoples, with our neighbors, not just next door to us, or not just in the communist group or communist party or study group that we're in, but with our comrades all around the world who are all fighting their own struggles, but whose struggles, when we bring them together, we can win the world. We can build another world. So comrades, my message is another world is possible. And Venezuela is the clearest example of that right now. Thank you.